Welcome to Miracle Nutrition with Hardy White. I'm Hardy White. Join me now as we explore the mysterious regions of the mind that allow us to perceive and experience all that is around us. What's it all mean? I'm here to explain that. I'll explain it in the first 10 minutes. So if you're busy. And then the remaining minutes are notes. What are you doing there, Hardy? I am doing a demonstration of something called cringe. And that's what today's show is about. It's about cringy things and what that means and what it is. And the song I was doing was one by internet sensation Mark Gormley, who is very intense. So it was a video of kind of a local Pensacola music show, like video music show called The Uncharted Zone. And there was a local fella who wrote songs and they made videos. And the videos are very amateurish and strange, you know. And the music, the fella's got a mustache and the Coke bottle glasses. And he looks like a, you know, a fellow at work who does something on the computer and is very quiet. And he's singing this sort of like rock anthem. And it's, you know, it reeks of sort of amateurishness, but it's wonderful. So people kind of are attracted to it, even though there's a degree of embarrassment. So that one's right on the line, you see. So what we're talking about is that feeling of being embarrassed for somebody and why we would do that when we see an entertainer or something, you go, ooh. And it has something to do with them unsuccessfully trying to conform and our fear of ostracism. Say, oh, I wouldn't want to be up there trying to conform and getting it wrong because then I might be ostracized. And that's a terrible feeling. Say, I'm all in on this worldview, but it turns out I do it poorly. And it's not all in on me. And my goodness, what a lovely area to explore. And that, in a way, is its own uncharted zone, isn't it? So that's where we're going to go to today. And some people might think, I'm a little embarrassing or cringy sometimes. So, oh, I'm embarrassed for you, Hardy. Maybe you're a little too sincere or something, or, you know, maudlin. Or maybe you were trying to do something that you thought was witty or entertaining, but it really missed the mark or something like that. And now I'm embarrassed. I feel feeling of embarrassment, but also pity and love, maybe. Now, you can have a cringe revulsion. Let's say somebody's trying way too hard to be accepted, and they don't understand the world that they're trying to be accepted by. So let's say I was saying, man, I suddenly like heavy metal music. I'd like to do some of this heavy metallic music, you know, but and I get it all wrong because I don't have a full understanding of it, and I'm trying to enter a world as a phony. And of course, you might cringe at that. It depends on what your fear is. I would love to do some sort of bespoke cringe. I try to do it when I know friends or something. If we go out together and you go, "Oh, Hardy, you're wearing sandals." And I would say, "Only because I know it bothers you." And you go, "Why would you do something? Is that aggressive or a thing?" No, I don't. Sometimes it's just playful. See, let's see how far I can push it. You know, how far are you willing to be seen in public with me? Is it really contingent on what hat I'm wearing or something? And oh my goodness, we want that kind of unconditional love. "Oh, I love you, Hardy, but don't sing any of your love songs, but they're so important to me. I love you, my love is from Buddha. I love and love my love. I sip it on the make it the bar." Now that might not have been cringy because I was mocking it and say, you can't fake the sincerity. It'd have to be something I really love, like a song I've really worked hard on, and I believe these lyrics are poetry. And you hear them and you go, "No, they're not poetry. They sound like ad copy if it was written by a monkey that didn't speak whatever language they were writing in." Which for a monkey, I guess, would be all of them. Oh, I don't know. Oh, my goodness, I'm so glad you're here with me. I try not to let this fear of ostracism interfere with expression of some emotions that I think are important. And I also think it's important to show vulnerability as role modeling. Now, I do it. Sometimes I think, well, what if nobody identifies with me? Then it is absolutely pointless. You'll say, right, well, if they looked up to you or something. Yeah, I guess, I'm trying to role model for all the... I'm the custodian here in the building, and I'm trying to role model for everybody by having dignity. Maybe that would be a good thing. Oh, my friends, I have instruments here today. I'm going to hold on to my guitar almost the whole time because I think there's nothing more cringy than a guitar. And in the wrong hands, just like a gun... by and large, they ought to be banned, probably. But there's something about them that we cling to. And they are really, can be an enabler for embarrassment, the guitar. I have, there's a thing called an open mic, which is a sort of bait for cringe. And I think I could do this. Now, I love confidence, and I love, here's a paradox, you have to have confidence to be an artist. But, what if you suck? And sometimes that's not even on the table as far as an option. Say, well, that's not it. I'm working hard. I'm dancing every day. There's no way I can suck. I'm going on Stairway to Stardom. And, I've been told I'm pretty good. So that's a thing, and then you go on and... you might have immortality on YouTube because people are embarrassed for you. And I've noticed that's a kind of a big thing. And it's a frightening thing. And some people want it. So, well, that's a good way to get attention. And they try to do it. And you almost can't force it, Maybe it's cringy to see somebody, desperation sometimes embarrasses us. So that's some people so hungry for fame. So quick to willing to sell out that it's transparent. But that doesn't mean that the people that are careful about their art aren't also that hungry for fame and driven by bad things. Something I noticed about the Mark Gormley song is that you wouldn't cringe if it was a Nirvana song because it could be. First of all, he's, if it's Kurt Cobain was a great vocalist, but he mumbled a little bit. Bless his heart, he would have made a terrible or great train announcer. Right? Because, and here's my impression of Kurt Cobain announcing the trains at Union Station. And it might go a little something like this. You were prepared to cringe. Cringing, is a physical reaction. It's kind of a pucker. You go, that's why they call it that. Because there's your face tightens up and you sort of want to disappear, and you want to kind of become a black hole or a collapsing star and kind of suck into yourself. And it's, you get that sourpuss thing. It's kind of a emotional alum, you know. You shudder. Sometimes you shudder. And it's, I have friends that are so sensitive to things. There's some chords that do that for them, even, or instruments. And I'm going to get one right now. Now, this is one of the early cringe acts that walked the line was a guy named Tiny Tim. Real name, Tim Tiny. And he was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and stuff, and maybe even before that, I don't know. But he was sort of a phenomenon of the 60s. So you had this weird, tall, unhip guy singing 1920 songs on a ukulele. Yes, that's the instrument that I'm talking about. That has been an irritant to the soul for now going on 100 plus many years. It's a tiny guitar. It was brought to the Pacific Islanders by very, very tiny Portuguese people. And for them, it was a full-size guitar. And they got there and said, "This is our guitar. And I like it." And they said, you know, it's a little tiny, you know, for robust Pacific Islanders. But then, it endured in the United States and in the UK and all over the world. Not all over the world. A lot of people hate it and have their own annoying instruments in their culture. And then in the United Kingdom and in this country in the 1920s, they had banjo ukuleles because I guess those are nearly lethal. That's like a machine gun. If these things are weaponed, the banjo ukulele can do great damage. And there was a guy named George Formby. And people in this country go, "Homer Formby, the paint stripper?" No, this is George Formby. "When I'm cleaning windows." He did like novelty songs on the banjo ukulele. And they say, "Oh, he must be hip. George Harrison liked him." You go, yes. That doesn't mean anything. George Harrison liked cigarettes. They're not so good for you, are they? So these banjo and the ukulele. So Tiny Tim, tiptoe. He sang in a falsetto, just like Mark Gormley. I think there's something also about the falsetto. People go, "Oh, it's going to go either way," because sometimes the falsetto, and it's baffling when it's okay and when it's not okay.
Tiptoe through the tulips, through the window. I don't know the chords, so I'm not going to try and sing them correctly.
Now I'm drifting into the avant-garde and it's okay again. So that's the thing. If he had gone off and started babbling or something, when people go, "Oh, you know, it's a tiny Eugene Chadbourne or something," but it's, if you stay on that line, if you want to be popular and you think, "Oh, people are like this intrinsically, that I sing as well as, you know, some great 20s act." I can't think of any. The old codger's not here to remind me. I forget which ones I'm supposed to hate. But it's in that tradition. And then, oh my gosh, the ukulele, it comes back every once in a while to haunt people. I think the worst, you know, the ukulele was, here's a lethal combination. The ukulele was a favorite of sort of like Ivy League fraternity people in the 1920s, wearing their raccoon coats and everything. And they're eating goldfish like it's crack. And what else did they do? They wore straw boaters. And I think they called each other old man. "I see you've got a ukulele there, old man. Let's play a few tunes for the ladies." Like that. But then it came back. What is it, in the 2000s or something? Now that I'm old, I don't understand decade differentiation. It's not as acute to me, I think. What year is that? Last, I don't know when. So that when the kids are going like, "This is from, you know, back in the day in 2010 or something." I was like, "Oh, shit, that's..." But there was a epidemic of playing the ukulele sort of wistfully and then whistling. And I would hear it on like airplanes, the whistly ukulele music, and you can sell people stuff with it. I'm not sure what. Vague things like insurance or something. Because it just makes you feel what? I don't like you. Got a care in the world. If you're a certain class. Because I don't know that anybody in certain... I think if you're solidly working class, that's probably not your fantasy, is to sit on a lawn with a ukulele. Like that, like it's a impressionist painting. Are they holding ukuleles? What are they even strumming in those old... Nothing. That's... You can't tell. It's impressionist. What's he got? I hope that's a flute in his hand. Oh, my goodness. I'm so glad to be with you. I've had that... I'm embarrassed for you, Artie. Are you? I might embarrass myself. I don't even know. My goodness. It's so easy to do. Is self-consciousness self-awareness? That's something to think about for a while. And I think self-consciousness is self-awareness within the context of a specific set of norms. And if you forget what they are, like if you have brain damage, it's liberating. And a lot of artists can simulate that brain damage. It's wonderful. Go to any museum. You'll see, are these people nuts or are they nuts like a fox nuts? And you'll find out that they're all fox nuts. And that's what we have those in the old country. Well, you're not going to hunt the fox and then not do anything with it. That's, oh my goodness, that feels like fox hunting. I don't mean to digress, and I don't think it is digressing, but if there's a sport where you hunt a thing that's small and fearful, and then once you catch it, I don't understand that completely. I think that if I was forced to hunt in the woods or something, say, the last berries I ate made me trip. I've got to eat a squirrel. I mean, it might come to that. And then I'd hunt. And then I would smear my face with mud or something, and I'd get that squirrel, and I'd cry, that weep the whole time I was eating it. I said, it's you or me, and I got to stay alive to take care of my kid or I wouldn't eat you, Father Squirrel. But I would hunt. But I don't think I'd hunt a fox, my goodness, on horseback. You know what's a great movie is Renoir's The Ruling Class, and there's a rabbit. They just shoot rabbits, which I guess they eat. But I think they really did it in the movie. And I sort of object to that. So I'll save you the time of seeing it. Don't bother seeing things with animal deaths in them. Say, well, that's just what they did back then. No. In Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev, there's some questionable things. I think there's a horse that falls about off a three-story building, and then there's a cow on fire. And he's like, oh, no, you know, that was all CGI. So I don't think so, but I believe that sometimes I can sum up some of those great art house films, I mean thematically, in a way that won't damage your soul or really give in to this idea that there has to be a suffering or sacrifice just to convey artistic ideas. I don't believe that necessarily. Oh, I have never suffered for my art necessarily. I don't think I have. Yes, I have, but I didn't want to. And it was also because I was wrong-headed about things. You know, that's possible. Because you may start for the wrong... You know, see a little kid that's a show-off or something. And they go, look at me, I got to look at me. And they're not really doing anything. You laugh. But their craving for attention goes on, and they keep saying, look at me. And finally, there's only... You can either dissuade the child from doing that at all, or you can say, look, if you're going to do that, you must learn some sort of skill in the business of show. And so, you know, it's like going to carnival. You know, I want to join the sideshow. Great. You know, pick one of these things that's not, if you don't have a birth defect, go ahead and you can sword swallow or pretend to be, you know, crazy. Those are the easiest ones. And then, you know, work up to things that are more skilled, like observational comedy. You know, I don't know that our best and brightest, what are they doing? Are they writing books? Are they doing stand-up? We're never clear about that. I believe that the, you say, well, comedy is difficult, so it can only be done by, I don't know. I think if you want to laugh with the comic, that's fine. But clowning, see, here's how we used to do it. That the person we were laughing, that was eliciting the laughs, we weren't kind of laughing with them. There's no need for that. They're a clown. We're laughing at a situation or laughing at a fool or something like that. When we start identifying with the performer, that's when things can get dangerous. Nobody identifies with the clown, really. A little bit they do. But what the clown is a literal scapegoat. Our sins are put upon the clown, and then it falls and trips, or it's trapped in a box or something like that. If there's a person standing on stage and they have this sort of teacherly demeanor and it looks like they're giving a lecture and then they're making observations like maybe a poet would and you're giggling along with them like they're an erudite bully and that's a different thing altogether. Now that can elicit a little bit of cringe because if you can see somebody doing it who's not good at it and people aren't laughing with them but at them or they and it's hubris. If you can spot hubris or desperation, those are the two things that'll get you to cringe, I think, a lot of times. Or just being completely out of touch or unaware.
You're hitting a nerve on me, Hardy. I would like to hear some of your songs.
Thank you. When I started in radio, I decided that I would be somewhat a mixture. And I would always try to add in some spice from the spice cabinet of radio talking that didn't fit, just to push it. You know, like your favorite restaurant. Say, we have pancakes today. That's fabulous. What are they? It'll be raisins and capers.
Do they go?
You'll be surprised, the sweet and salty with the pancake. No, you know what I mean? So maybe the next week you come back, it's just raisin pancakes, and probably be back to just plain pancakes eventually. But that's what you want a little bit, isn't it? You know, you want failure. I love it's a great, there's a spice called, it's called asafoetida or something like that, and it smells like garbage onions or something. And it's used in South Asian cooking, and I love it. And what do they call it? Meth? They have a different name. They don't call it meth. It's something like that. Your comment's blowing up now. But it's so funny. It smells like rotten eggs or something, but it's context, you know, and that can be a dimension of something. So you say, Hardy, you have a vague rotten egg smell. I go, I know. I'm trying to expand your palate. Also, I'm trying to conform and not conform at the same time. It's so difficult. Some conformity is necessary, you know, because you do not want to be a bad neighbor. You do not want to be a bad subway companion. You do not want to do that. I don't want to stand on public transport and subject you to some sort of Dada theater. It's not fair. And so, you're struggling. And I would not do that. It's all context. And so I try not to. Here's a little song I wrote. Hey, folks. I'm glad. Just want to thank everybody at Mike's Bar. Come out here for the open mic. And, gosh, I haven't been up here in so long. It's been so long. And I've written so many new songs. And they add up. And I was just going to pick favorites, but I love them all. And a lot of people saying, do the old ones everybody loves. And I want to do that. But also, you got to understand, these are like fresh on my mind. These are thoughts I'm having now. So a lot of the things that I've done here at the open mic before, those songs, all the ones on the All But Me tape, That's the past for me. And so I've got some new stuff I'm working on. And that's the stuff that I want to share with you today. Is that even the... this first one... I'm not going to capo. This first one is about... I was traveling in Europe. I had to get out of here, and I knew that I would be inspired by the south of France, and well, all over France, and like such greats as like Dick Rivers and everything. It's a musical inspiration generally, and I knew I wanted to come back here, and I was wandering through France I had a long baguette over my shoulder, and tied to the end of the baguette was a little sack. It was a little bump, you know, a little hobo sack, but the stick was a baguette. And I get the looks, people would stop for photographs and everything. And as I was doing that, I've just pictured myself back here sitting on this bar stool at Mike's at the open night, open mic night, thinking about, you know, my song Baguette Hobo Stick that I was writing in my head. And it's a funny little thing, gosh. And it's not, if you call it a novelty song, I'm going to be incensed. Because the Baguette Hobo Stick, what was happening there is that I was acknowledging that travel was my nourishment. I'm moving through France like a sailboat with no sail. Baguette stick on my shoulder with a bag of my dreams inside of it. Hang on just a second. Unacceptable. Starting over. But let me just interject a minute there, because I see I'm getting a symbol. Mike is making I don't know what he's doing. Whether it's that wrap it up or I'm crazy. Just give me two. I've got five songs. I'm in and out. It's going to be, and this will probably be the last performance in a while. So I know that a lot of people that are coming up next are going to cut me some slack. Because I probably won't be back in a long time. And I'm going to leave you with these things, and I want you to remember me by them. And usually they don't permit this, but I do have a merch table over there if you want to get some stuff and CDs and shirts and pocket warmers and things like that. And also we have one of those things that looks like a business card, but it's a sponge. Here we go. In the dawn, your eyes, they are glowing like lights on the shore, and I adore some more lights. Jazz place. I'm gonna just put the guitar down for a minute. You know, I'll tell you, I wanted the first time I saw anybody doing anything with combining music and jokes was I'm sure it's Smothers Brothers, but that's a little bit before my time, because when I was watching them, I was a little kid, and I didn't get it. And I thought, oh, this is annoying. This is horrible. But as I got older, I think as a teenager, I got a Martin Mull album. And he was doing like fun novelty songs and doing kind of stand-up and being sarcastic and everything. And I thought, that's absolutely lovely. And one of my first thoughts was, it'd be great to do this completely wrong. But I don't think that, and then along came my Andy Kaufman and I was in heaven. So, you know, there you go. Oh, maybe that Andy came first. I don't know. But that was very interesting to me. And I thought, you can look at that. Look what's happening there. You get to explore your feelings about performance. Not just the performer, but like performance itself. Like, what is it? Why am I being fooled by somebody who's clearly on a stage? That's the thing that had fascinated me with Andy. Because he introduced cringe in his act. And you were supposed to feel sorry for this foreign man. But come on. Like, you look now and you say, how easily fooled are you? But it's really context. Maybe you don't expect it. I would like to do it in church where people really don't see it coming. Do some kind of performance art. You know, ingratiate yourself to a group of religious people, join their congregation, spend maybe years immersing yourself, and then not anything horrible, but like, you know, once you're invited to read from the holy book or something, just introducing like a tick where you're maybe every once in a while you talk like Jerry Lewis or something. You know, I don't know. It's just an idea, you know. I can't think of any prayers. I was going to do it, but now I can't. All of a sudden I can't. The Lord is scrambling my mind and I can't think of, you know. He could say, our Father who art in heaven, like that. I don't know that anybody would call you on it because maybe they're used to not. And who knows how people, that's how, and you could just say it's how I was raised. You know, you say in the Lord's Prayer, you say debtors, I say trespassers or something like that. Or I say debtors, but I say it like Jerry Lewis.
Debtors!
Is it Jerry Lewis? I'm really doing Paul Frees doing a Jerry Lewis impression. Everything I know is meta. That's because that is actually the way that we perceive the world. That's the nature of memory. We don't retrieve things intact like a machine. So let's say you see, you know, some scene or something, and you're remembering it, some episode. And when you remember, you can't recover all the details, so you fill them in with details that you know should be there. So if it was in a church, you know, you might decorate it. There were pews and everything that should be there, whether they were there or not. And then when we retrieve the memory, we keep adding things to it. Just it's a copy of a copy of a copy. We don't always get things in order. I had a long discussion with a friend called the Elvis impersonator paradox, where you don't experience cultural time in a linear fashion. So you might be exposed to a parody of something before you're exposed to the actual thing. So you might be exposed to an impression of a performer before you ever see the performer. So when you, in your mind, recall original voice, you're not really recalling. You know, you have to like study history to get the order of things. And even though it's kind of confusing, I've tried to, because, you know, I have an interest in the Three Stooges. So when you start looking at things that have their origin in live vaudeville and theater like that, people were borrowing and stealing ideas and gags from each other constantly because the chance of being caught is low if you're just touring. If there's no TV, right, you know, you can do something endlessly on tour, and if the person you stole from doesn't catch up with you, you're good. So people borrowed things from each other's acts and stuff turns up, you know, like slowly I turned, step by step, Niagara Falls, that kind of thing. Finding the origin of that stuff is almost impossible. It's really hard because sometimes, you know, sometimes the person who innovated it doesn't get noticed until after they've already been stolen from. And so it's really hard to claim any originality. Now, if someone has that's why we cringe at some things, because you think if anybody likes this, they lack sophistication. They don't understand the story. They're liking the wrong thing. So if they like the Elvis impersonator, you know, just intrinsically, you go, wait, wait, you don't know. Or if you say, oh my gosh, I love the blues, mainly Led Zeppelin. You say, well, wait a minute. That's the kind of thing. And it for music, for purists and people understand timelines and everything, can be a real irritant for people like myself who are neutral agents of chaos. It's very exciting. It's very exciting because all these things, every time a curtain is pulled down, we get a little more detail. And it doesn't matter whether the pieces don't fit. Don't try to put it all together. That's where you're going wrong. So every time I get more experience and evidence, I try to cobble together a story and a puzzle that will explain it. There you're going. That's the problem. That might be the problem. You know, because the things in the past also, they dissipate and they become sort of like untrue. Nothing sort of stays put. And this is very disconcerting. And people struggle with it. And it causes, I believe, just a collective psychosis. Because you see people clinging to the past as if your ancestors had some sort of like direct line to the creation, and that you're just, you know, if you could only figure out their intent. But it's just a bunch of confused children in perpetuity, scattered around like that, thinking that there's a solution. It's wonderful to watch everyone so intently, vigorously playing what they think is Jumanji. And it's really a 52 pickup or something like that. So I love it. I'm in my element. So are you going to get to a point that's, oh, there's nothing more irritating than something not having a point when you need it. I had something stuck in my tooth the other day, and my tongue was an inadequate instrument to extract it. Do you know what I'm saying? I believe it was a fruit seed, one of those very tiny ones, diminutive fruit seed lodged in the crevices of one of my molars, and my tongue, soft, blunt, ineffective, good for, what, speaking, licking, pointing if my hands are full. And I was trying to extract it with that, and it was inadequate. I needed one of those horrible bent needles that the dentist used, or the hygienist, as they scrape and prod. But I wasn't. I just had this thing, like trying to, it was like trying to use a sponge to drive in a screw. And I just had a good kid. That's a good one. No, it's not. Then I realized, you know, that that's that the tongue is all I have against all my experience too. That's all I have to share it with, and it's as ineffective. My speech is what? Communicating is like trying to get a raspberry seed out of your tooth. That's all I'm saying. And it's using the tongue is a very hard way to do it. And I don't know if there's a more efficient way to do it. And if there is, I'm not sure I like it. That's all I'm saying. And I'm saying, being embarrassed for other people, examine it. I've been to some places where I feel like maybe a little cringe would help. You know, because that if the unselfconsciousness is a product of hubris, then maybe it would help if there was just a tiny little non-fatal humiliation, just a course correcting. I've done that with me. I really wanted to perform music and be in bands and everything. And I remember starting out, you know, watching some videos or cassettes or listening to performances and thinking, oh, God, I'm embarrassing myself. This is a plea, adjust. And you've got to find that nice sweet spot between your abilities and your ideas, and you know, which ideas are worth communicating, and which ones are within my abilities. How entertaining can I be? How engaging can I be? Can I learn the skills necessary to keep people's attention and to make them think or dance or something like that? So I tried all those things. Now, dancing is pretty, it's not easy, but there's some shortcuts to it. And you can kind of shut up, too. You don't necessarily need to sing. And that can ruin it. Yes, I've heard some great bands, and they're great until the singer comes out and goes, "That's a bad bullet," and then it's all over. And I've heard people with gorgeous voices, and they have a crap band behind them, and it's still good. Because I guess it is, it's the voice. But, a lot of people go, "Oh, my solo, you're dissing my solo guitar performances. My non-virtuosic guitar performances at open mics that have the flavor of middle school recitals." It's like you're making tremendous progress on your instrument, and you seem to be writing little songs that are naive versions of the things you're hearing in class. So that's what that's most of the time what's happening. And I'm not sure why people go on and say, I love this song. I'm going to go perform this song in public. It's by a singer I love, and I was really moved by it. Now I'm going to go to, it's just not the same always. And Hardy, putting people down. I'm not. You know, I'm trying to break free of all this that's keeping this happening. I'm trying to destroy the ability, the need to cringe, the need to fit in. Because I think if people were really expressing themselves, there would be more originality because they wouldn't be constantly turning and checking what others are doing. And that's what you have to do that. And when you don't do it, that's, you know, you're taking a terrible, not a terrible chance, but if you're ambitious, well, maybe no one will ever notice me if I'm doing my mumble yell music that no one's done before. So that's it. You know, or if you're making a hybrid or of two types of entertainment. It's like I love metal, and I was going to say opera, but they're already wed, you know. I don't know. Those things are a lot of things like that that are, God, I all of a sudden can't think of this band, something Apocalypse. Oh, forget. They're great. They've got like an opera singer and stuff. Oh, my goodness. What are you getting at? What are you talking about, Hardy? I honestly don't know. Oh, Flesh God Apocalypse. How could I forget Flesh God Apocalypse? Great band. Not at all cringy. Great. What is it? What don't you like? I don't know. Eurovision. Sometimes you go, because they're trying, that's a try too hard kind of thing to me, and it's easy to miss the mark. Oh, my friends, who made you a critic? Nobody, thank goodness. Oh, my gosh, people who listen to this show they don't care what I say. They're not looking to me for some opinion to discuss, I don't think. I think most are just trying to say, well, this is keeping me awake until I get home. And I would love to not perish on some New Jersey highway, or, you know, Lord, get me home. Hardy will keep me awake, but I see constantly, but that's a tempo and volume change will do it. Because that's what I mean, what is radio but frequency modulation and amplitude modulation? That means I vary the frequency of what I say and the amplitude of it. So that sometimes I'm loud, my gosh. You know, one of the things that I love about WFMU is the screaming. I mean, just there's so many people that know how to ride that mic. It's beautiful knowing to pull back and let it rip in the studio, because it really does sound, it sounds great on the radio. I love big emotions do sound good to me on the radio. But also small, intimate ones do, too. I mean, if it's late at night. That's my next goal, is to be on real late at night going, "Hey, I bet you're feeling sexy." Or maybe not. Maybe sleepy. Sleepy and sexy and maybe nauseous if you just lie down, because you could have a little bit of acid reflux. Hey, I want to be your stomach acid that's coming up to greet you. Say hi. I'm sorry that I'm a bit of an irritant. It's 'cause I'm hot and on fire. In anticipation. Yeah, that's why the stomach acid creeps up in your throat. Think I'm gonna get a treat. Like a, I don't know, gum. That's why you shouldn't chew gum if you have acid reflux. Yeah. Hey, what time is it? It's late at night and you're listening to some sexy late night tunes with Hardy White. And my show, just a sheet, but my feet are sticking out or something like that. I don't know. That's how I sleep. It runs in the family. We just like, no matter how cold it is, everything covered, feet have to breathe. Just a rule. Head doesn't even. You can put my head in a bag. But I don't know whether I'm from another planet, but those feet, they got air out. And it's worked out great for me because I have great podiatric health. I am currently in a walking cast, but that's for a tendon problem. Oh, my friends. Yes, could I do that? Morning I couldn't do. Because you'd go right back to sleep, and I would be the type of morning DJ that encouraged that. You know, like, hey, man, you don't even go to work. What's work is whack. This is going to be day one of, I guess this is it. Here we go. No, it'd be terrible, and you don't want that. My goodness. Where you want the freedom is at night or something like that. But I also like being on while you're driving or getting ready to eat. A lot of people said, over the years, Hardy, I can't tell you how many times I've sliced the tip of my finger off listening to your show. Because I'll laugh or something, just some dicing carrots. And I'll say, you don't fold them, fold the tips under your knuckles. Lead with your knuckles. That's what should be touching the side of the knife blade. And if their tips are tucked under. And that's what you're holding the... Goodness, I wish I had a TV show. I could show you everything I've learned over the years. It's all random. It's not connected to anything. And that's where you're running into the... You go to school to get these. You go to college to get these teachers. And you take this class and they go, yes, I've spent all my life studying the French Revolution. Well, you take my class and you'll learn how to replace a garbage disposal. You'll learn a little bit of the history of Japanese avant-garde. I mean, I just throw it all in there. I know a little bit, and nothing is connected enough to make me an authority. But that's not what you want. That's not what you need. Like, you don't need a plumbing degree. You just need to fix the darn disposal. That's what I'm saying. And so it's lovely to have that kind of learning in your life, and I believe that I might have that relationship with you. So I learn a little something from you, Artie, even if it's the type of person I don't want to be. Oh, thank you. Or mannerisms I don't want to have, or expressions, artistic choices, things like that. Music choices. My gosh, I've gotten some of your premiums, and I've been whelmed. Oh, so what's that? Well, I have not been overwhelmed. Okay, that's... Oh, well. But I've not been underwhelmed. I've just merely been whelmed by most of your artistic output over the years. Well, thank you. And I feel like that's a good thing for me. I have ambition. What is my ambition? I don't know. But I like to do stuff and make stuff. You know that. You know that. Who knows that? I know that. You know that about me. And it might be true for you, too. And say, well, yeah, I try not. And you might be cagey about your ambition because you realize the limitations of your skill. And so, well, I dearly love music, but I am under no illusion that people are clamoring for it. That kind of creator, right? So you need motivation sometimes because the motivation isn't the record company calling you. It's just that I know I want to make, but I keep... Some people use that for pooing. I know I want to poo out art. But I know when to make art, but I'm sometimes really struggle for a reason to do it. Can you help me, Hardy? And can you help me not make people cringe? And well, I say, well, what's worked for me is that you use cringe like you would
poison.
No, that's stupid. Oh, hot sauce, maybe? You got to acclimate. Put a little in your work. Put things in your work, like a pun or something. I see people doing it all the time. I see TV shows doing it that are normally like sitcoms or something that are pretty sophisticated, but they will throw in a groaner. And I love that. I like that because they're not above it, you know? And it feels good. It feels like flavor instead of pain or what else. So over the years, I have tried to be sincere occasionally, and or even vulnerable, which can make people uncomfortable, but not predominantly vulnerable, just like a little bit, you know, I never even thought about, you know, adding a little bit of that to my bisque. But it really sort of cuts the richness or something. And I believe in that wholeheartedly, because I think even though cringing is a sort of sympathetic mortification, that we're feeling embarrassed for somebody, and embarrassment comes from their unawareness or naivete or some character flaw that is going to cause them to be ostracized, which is one of our worst nightmares. So what do we do about it? How do we keep it as a way of, you know, making sure we're self-aware? But how do we destroy its oppressiveness and its use to keep people conforming? Because that's how it's been weaponized. And when embarrassment like that is weaponized, it can be weaponized to ensure conformity. And that's what I think is going on, and that's why I almost faked crying just then. That's just, it's an impulse. You got to do it naturally, you know? You've got a Jack Parr kind of thing where you're just like, I'm going to just be bipolar in public. And then you're getting, you know, people notice, I love the ride. I can't believe, this is another thing, is occasionally we would turn into the show and it will seem like an old radio show. There'll be skits. Now, the reason I do skits is because the word alone makes me upset. I get, absolutely, it makes me cringe. So there's a couple words that make me cringe and you can use them to wound me. One is, I enjoyed the skit. Thank you. I loved when you were riffing. That's another one. When you were riffing on something. I go, Okay. So all the like things like that hurt. So I try to do them. And that way, I don't know. It's not quite self-flagellation. It's more like when you acclimate yourself to something, you know? I'm gonna be doing a marathon, so I better need to do some running. That's what I think. I'm gonna be. I could possibly embarrass myself, so I better embarrass myself a little bit. Get used to it. Get used to getting over it. And getting over it is an amazing superpower. There was a period of time just in the '90s where I was watching baseball, and I was just mainly watching the Braves, and I was just mainly watching Tom Glavine and Maddox. So Maddox and Glavine and Schmaltz. I say Schmoll, I say Smoltz. And so I'd watch them, and they were great. And they were at their height of their powers and everything. But what I noticed about them was their ability to get over the last pitch. Like, just to detach and start fresh. It didn't get in their head. Even if it was a good one, like the next pitch seemed emotionally detached from the last. Now, I don't know if they could continue that, but maybe it was just something that was happening, a sort of like Zen overall confidence. But that was the lesson that I got from baseball those couple of years that I watched, It was like, how well do you recover? Because, you know, it's this moment that matters. And once the thing is, deed is done, good or bad, it really is in the past. And you can think about it, chew on it, ruminate it. But that's what you're doing. You're ruminating. What's ruminating? So there's some animals that chew their cud. So let's say like a cow, they got a second rumen stomach. And they eat some grass and they swallow it. And they go, you know what? I'm going to chew on that some more. And they cough it up again. That's ruminating. And we use it to mean, you know, doing that with memories and thoughts and everything, and puking them back up and chewing on them like they were double mint and not memory puke.
Hardy.
What?
Who are you?
I don't know. If you figure it out, you let me know. The Hardy White Show at yahoo.com. Part of me loves email, part of me doesn't. So what part doesn't? The part that has to answer it doesn't. It's just the concentrating. It isn't you. You've seen me when we're together interacting. I'm better. Just not a very good pen pal because I think I've written you back because I wrote you back in my head. Things like that. That just made me realize that I'd done that to a friend again. Oh my gosh. How do I have any friends when I keep doing that? You are so important to me, WFMU listener. I don't say that enough, and I hope I'm encouraging enough. You know, I get silly, and I think, well, am I using this time enough to help or be nurturing or to spread kindness or anything or hope? I hope I am. It's not always what's on my mind, and I don't want to indulge my frustration or anger or anything. I'd love to be able to offer you food that I haven't accidentally spit in because I was, you know, somebody's barbecuing for you and they're going on about politics. I can't believe that's not put pie with my pie. And you know, you go, oh, that's lovely. My vegetarian hot dog has a saliva spray on it from your vitriol. So I'm not gonna spit on your wiener. That's my motto here. I was about to eat a frozen pizza the other day, and I was looking at the box. You know, and some of these pizza companies make you think that, like, somebody's family, this is our grandparents making pizza, like, and that it's some family company, and they're just all around the living room making frozen pizzas or making pizzas and then shoving them into some cryogenic chamber and mailing them out. So it has this, you know, the story of the family or the business on the back or something. You know, our family's been around since, you know, Italy, or I don't know. And then it says, our family motto is, if we can't pronounce it, we don't use it. Like, what? I mean, so like grandpa says apostrophe, so we never use possessive nouns. No, I don't know. What do you mean by that? I think it's supposed to be sort of the anti-intellectual, xenophobic kind of, like, you know, if it's got some kind of crazy name like Matagalaka Chaka Mata Matafuck. But that's a lot of times that's just a preservative that should be in there, maybe. But I don't know what they mean, or maybe they mean like arugula. I was baffled. I don't know what you can pronounce and can't pronounce. Yeah, you know, we're Habsburgs. And so a lot of the things like, we can't pronounce if you don't use it. So I don't know what they're talking about. Like physically they can't. I think too much about not thinking. And then I do it. Oh, I bless you so much. You're listening to Miracle Nutrition on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, 91.9 in New York City and Rockland County, and online at WFMU.org. That is Worldwide Freeform Radio, the way that it was originally intended to be formed, which is free. And it's free to you and the freedom. It's free literally and literally, but just pertaining both economically and intellectually. And artistically, I love you.
Twins' name was Ebony. Her name was Mahogany. Twins' name was Ebony.